Group meeting, Sunday, 25th June, 1984. The whole world is at a turning point in its history. It will take some considerable time to show in which ways it will actually turn. But it will turn in all the aspects which concern both our secular life and our spiritual life. The world of religion itself must necessarily undergo a tremendous renovation. Religion as we have known it, insofar as doctrines and teachings are concerned, is now at a point where so many beliefs and conceptions must be discarded. We have been dealing with this since last autumn. But it is interesting to note how some of these beliefs and conceptions came about. Religion, even today, is associated very largely with the different rituals which are practiced all over the world, in all the faiths, including Hinduism and Buddhism. Although the Upanishads and the Buddha both taught that rituals are unnecessary, that they don't lead to the fulfillment of human evolution, particularly in terms of the evolution of consciousness. The Upanishads and the Buddha insisted upon the whole process of purification and of living the good life, the righteous life, as Zarathustra called it. The teaching about righteousness, meaning the practice of virtue throughout one's life, was in fact started by Zarathustra. Remember, he was 3,500 years, he flourished 3,500 years ago. And the term which is used for righteousness, also for purity, for the truth, is Asha. Asha. This doctrine of Asha has borne good fruit throughout all these centuries. There is no doubt about that. Associated with Asha, because remember, Zarathustra was one of the original Aryan-speaking Indo-European peoples. He was a member of those people, of that race. That section of the Aryan-speaking peoples who went over into India and spread through the Indo-Gangetic plain in the course of 1,000 years ultimately, they called it Ritta, order, justice, perfection, which is this order is inherent in the whole of creation. And all aspects of creation which are evolving and moving out towards their fruition have Ritta or Asha inherent in them. It is a power which brings to fruition, which makes all things new. But it is a power which, where we human beings are concerned, has to be understood by us first and foremost. And if we understand it rightly, then we can put it into practice. You know how, for instance, the Buddha in his noble eightfold path put right understanding, perfect understanding, as the first step, the very first item in the eightfold path, perfect understanding, which could then be followed by perfect speech, action, etc., etc. Because if one doesn't understand, how is one to live up to it? It becomes impossible. It is because the understanding of the human race has always fallen short of what is implied in that fundamental teaching of, call it righteousness, purity, truth, or whatever you like. Because the human race has always been short of understanding of its real meaning, its implications and its significance, that the world has been in trouble continuously throughout thousands of years, literally. Now, the human race, of course, started several million years ago, but our understanding and our sense of religion and worship, which has culminated in our modern sense of religion and worship, started about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, especially amongst the Indo-European peoples who roamed the steppe lands of Central Asia. They had a developed theology. They thought that everything that happens in nature is controlled by spirits, and groups of spirits had their chief, who was a god. Not just one god, but several gods like that. So they had the spirits of the trees and the river, even a bridge had a spirit, and so forth. That started something like 5,000 to 6,000 years ago. And a system of worship developed because the powers of nature, the great powers of nature, were so powerful that they could be very destructive and hurtful to human beings. Flood, tempest, earthquake, and so on. Raging fires. And therefore, as they thought, that they should somehow make friends with them, placate them, and thus placatory rites came into being, and the first systems of worship as such. They didn't understand that they themselves were evolving forwards towards a supreme goal, which was, shall we say, in the plan of nature. They didn't understand that. They were content to stay put for long periods of time, for several millennia, with their systems of placatory rites and worship. Of course, despite their slowness, development did take place. And that branch of the Aryan-speaking peoples, which went down into eastern Iran, now it is Afghanistan. It is no longer part of Iran, but it was eastern Iran in those very ancient days. They went down there and they believed in these rites in the sense that the rites which they carried out were not only placatory rites, but they were rites which could practically compel the gods to be on their side and to bring about desirable results. In short, they believed in magic. That the sacrificial ritual was a great magic which would placate the particular deity for whom that rite was practiced, that sacrifice was made. And there were rather terrible sacrifices, mainly of animals, sometimes of human beings too. You know how it is said that the Druids had human sacrifice. And that's very close to our times. It's practically yesterday, so to say, or day before yesterday, compared with the huge span of human existence. There came the time when, especially those who were known as the fire priests, the Athravans, the Angirasas of India, you see, these Athravans were regarded as the most capable wielders of the good magic which would bring the gods to on the side of humans and help humans. According to the view which humans had as to how the gods should help them, well-being, health, pleasure, I have said wealth, yes, and so forth, you see. Very, very material-minded indeed. Zarathustra was at the climax of these Athravans, the fire priests, and he, being what he was, gifted as he was, probably had a considerable sense of unitary wholeness. So what he did was to abolish all the deities, all the minor deities, and install one supreme deity, Ahura Mazda, as the one supreme god, the Lord of Truth and everything that is good and so forth. The very embodiment of Asha, virtue. So it was he who started the great monotheistic movement, which of course has flowered out in terms of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, the great monotheisms. But Zarathustra was the first to start off all that. He was also the first to teach that the soul of man, this was just an arbitrary teaching, there was nothing to show whether man had a soul or not. The soul of man was considered to be part of the divine creative spirit, Ahura Mazda himself. You see, not only the soul, but what was called the Fravashi was a spark of this spirit embodied in man. Howsoever man lived, whatsoever he did, this Fravashi could never be stainted. It always remained divine and pure. It was the soul, the Urvan. In modern Persian, it is Ravan. That could be tainted. Now, the soul was what incarnated in the body. And he taught that according as the living body in the world thought and felt and behaved and acted, according to that, the soul would receive the consequences of whatsoever was done whilst alive throughout all time. That meant either a heaven or a hell for all time. Zarathustra never made the mistake of trying to describe the heaven and so forth. But he insisted upon the absolute justice of the Supreme Being. And the Supreme Being had to keep a tremendous account throughout the centuries. All human beings who were born, the account was kept by the Supreme Being, and he meted out hell or heaven to the people for all time. But Zarathustra was quite original and remarkable, particularly in this way. He taught that at the end of time there would come a resurrection, and all the souls, whether they had expiated or not expiated their sins, and the good souls of course had nothing to expiate, they would obtain again their old bodies, the body which died on earth. Of course, there was no explanation at all how on earth the old bones could possibly be enfleshed again and the soul could pick out the right one. Maybe husbands and wives and fathers and children, parents and children sometimes made a mighty muddle with the whole business of picking out the right body. But I'm just poking fun at the theory. Anyhow, this resurrection took place, and then there was a final ordeal. The final judgment takes place. Two of the great angels would melt all the metals in the earth, which would flow as a glowing river. And all human beings would have to pass through this bodily. Those who were the good ones would feel it as warm milk. Those who were the bad ones would get exterminated with the second judgment. Now you read the book of Revelation, and you'll find that towards the end of it, writings by St. John the Divine, similar to this idea. You see, I'm telling you all this because Zarathustra's ideas were the parent of all the deep teachings of deep in the sense of serious beliefs and doctrines of all the other monotheistic religions. And with that river would flow into hell and completely exterminate Satan, the evil one, the foul fiend, and all the demon hosts. Other writings, and these came much later, well over 1500 years after Zarathustra's death, much more than 1500 years after his death, all these writings came. The good angels would fight with their opposite numbers and destroy them. Of course, it had to be a fairy tale ending. The absolute triumph of good and the absolute destruction of all evil. Now you'll notice that in this original monotheistic teaching, there is not much room for compassion, for for a purification process which would enable everyone to find the happy ending. There is not that. That aspect took 1,000 years, when, particularly with the uprising of the Buddha, to come into being. Compassion, as the Buddha taught, was quite unknown to Zarathustra and his times. And redemption, as taught in Christianity, was also quite unknown. There was the absolute justice of God, which would completely destroy evil, which incidentally he himself had brought into being, because he taught that the Supreme Being created two spirits. One was the good spirit and the other was the evil spirit, and they came out of his own being. Now you see the utter illogicality of all these old ideas in the religions. And it is not only in Zarathustrianism, you will find it in all the monotheistic religions. Zarathustra's greatest and most wonderful teaching was, of course, that whosoever does evil brings evil into the world. He, of course, made it specific to the individual. The evil doer would receive the evil results of his doing, and the good doer would receive the good results of his doing, you see. There was no conception that no person can do a good or an evil action as the sole agent. There are always so many other influences which come to play upon this. This is where Buddhism also failed in its presentation of karma. Both Hinduism and Buddhism failed in this. They didn't realize that things happen in terms of great wholes, wholes. You see, they don't happen in terms of individual particles, and in science too we know that that is the case, but in on a sort of a macroscopic scale rather than a microcosmic scale. On the microcosmic scale, particular actions are done, deeds of thought, of speech, of body are done, but they bring about a macrocosmic result, because this particular action was the result of a large number of forces which culminated in this action, and this action affects the totality. So the totality reaps, and in fact the totality sows. St. Paul was quite wrong in saying, As you sow, so you shall reap. You are not the exclusive sower, and you are never the exclusive reaper. Take a simple example in a worldly context. A man makes a fortune because he has the skill and the ability and whatever it is, and maybe the wickedness and the villainy involved in making mighty fortunes. Supposing a man makes a mighty fortune, you see. Now, he leaves that to his children, who will say, let us assume, that they haven't got anything like the ability that this man had. Now, in which way do the children deserve all that? You see, the absurdity of the whole idea, the equilibrating idea, mechanically equilibrating idea, is absolute nonsense. There's no such thing. So now, similarly, the idea of heaven and hell is a completely ridiculous idea. And still more ridiculous is the idea that there is something called a soul, which, mind you, is declared to be immortal, which can suffer both ways and can be exterminated in Zarathustra's teaching at the end. Mind you, Zarathustra didn't teach all that. It was, as I say, over 1500 years after his death that the Zarathustrian writers who produced scriptural texts, who produced all this nonsense. But unfortunately, this nonsense has infected all the religions of the world. Even the Buddha said, taught karma in terms of, you have done this, that and the other, and therefore now this is happening to you. Throughout the, particularly throughout the long discourses, you find time and again the Buddha saying, now it is to be understood this way, and so on. So now, the time has come when it is our task to clean up the world of religion. The millions of followers of the separate religions will never do it. They haven't got the intelligence, they haven't got the moral and mental strength and ability to do anything of the sort. They have no such willingness. They want to stick to the letter of the scriptures as such and carry on in the same old stupid way. How right Carlyle was. The world consists of so many hundred millions, mostly fools. And that unfortunate fact is a fact today. Look at the world today. How many people are wise? There are millions who are knowledgeable. They know this, they know the other, etc. But how many are wise? Look at the problems that the world faces today. There is the terrible fear of the misuse of nuclear energy. And it's a very real problem, the misuse of nuclear energy, which could easily take place both deliberately, I mean either deliberately or accidentally, or maybe both ways. One never knows. Then there is the problem of the expanding population of the world. And then there is the problem of pollution, which is a worldwide problem. People have no idea of how they are living suicidally, poisoning the atmosphere, which slowly and surely will kill off probably plant life first, the factories which belch out these quantities of the oxides of nitrogen and sulfur particularly, then the moisture in the atmosphere, the clouds dissolve these oxides and form acids, nitrous acid, nitric acid, sulfuric acid, sulfurous acid, and so forth. And these acids fall with the rain. The rain consists partly of these acids, which destroy plant life. And not only destroy plant life, but when they fall into lakes and rivers and the seas, they destroy life in the ocean too. So that sooner or later, all this will tend to poison our life too, as such. If the plant world goes west, a good deal of the animal world will go west. The animals that human beings eat, cows and sheep and their children and so forth, the dear little lambs, what happens to the dear little lambs? They are murdered for our sake. So they eat that the poisoned grass, and their bodies will bear the effects of that, and we eat that. I don't, said he very righteously. But still, we must laugh at ourselves sometimes. But this is really very serious. We are faced with these problems. And of course, people are not altogether ignorant of the problems. There is a great, there are so many movements which are concerned with the human welfare and the welfare of the plant world and the welfare of the animal world and so forth. And they are trying to do this, that and the other. But none of these things will ever succeed completely or sufficiently. None. I'm not suggesting for a moment that these things shouldn't be done. Of course they should be done. The techniques should go on, and fresh techniques should be discovered and applied. But what is most important of all is to discover the root source of it all. Now the root source of it all is I myself. You yourself. That is the root source. It is my greed which wants that state of self-indulgence which necessitates the unpleasant and horrible things to be done and for these destructive forces in nature to come into existence. It is my fear and my suspicion which separates me from my neighbors, from people in other lands, people with other ideas and ideologies and so forth. One can see that somebody's ideology or idea is a wrong one, is a harmful one, and doesn't really lead to human fulfillment. But one need not hate, therefore. But where there is fear and suspicion, there is always hate. And I am the one who does the hating. So that this is what I have to deal with, first and foremost. And then concern myself with all the technical devices to prevent harm taking place with human beings. Then again, there is a vast amount of illusion and delusion in me myself. And because I am deluded, because, for example, the great illusion from which all mankind suffers, if I have a lot of money, I can be happy and safe and well and all the rest of it. But is that the case? To supply the real needs of mankind is absolutely essential, otherwise we couldn't live at all. But those real needs are very few. Food, shelter, warmth. Take the case of food, for instance. What sort of food do we eat? Is it scientifically balanced? Is it obtained without harming anything or anybody? Or any creature whatsoever? Take the case of shelter and warmth, which we can class together under comfort. If you don't have a home, if you don't have warmth, you'd be extremely uncomfortable, and many old people die of hypothermia, lack of warmth, and so forth. You see. But do I need three houses, or do I need just one house? I have seen with my own eyes in India, in the poor little villages, the extraordinary contentment with the what we would quite legitimately call the utterly uncomfortable conditions under which those people live. But they are peaceful, they are happy, and they are very human and religiously inclined, although unfortunately largely in the absurd way, just their usual rituals and ceremonies and whatnot and whatnot. So the solution to the world problem starts with the solution for the individual. And this is where religion in the real sense comes in. Religion is a relating back, a return to the source from which we come. Now obviously, a living body or an animal or a plant can't return to the original primordial creative energy which brought all this into being. It can't return like that. But what can return? What in us can return? Is it not our state of consciousness, our state of awareness of truth, of reality? That is what can return. We are conscious in terms of separateness, of isolatedness. As long as we remain isolatively and separatively conscious, we will always be possessive, aggressive. It's the reptilian brain in us which will be active, and we shall never produce a harmony either within ourselves or in society or in the world as a whole. So it is our consciousness which has to undergo a change, our innermost consciousness. This innermost consciousness is something which is invisible to us. We can't know it by the ordinary process of self-observation. We can never know it. I think in Upanishadic teaching we have perhaps the nearest, some of the best presentations of it. Consciousness is the source of, is the energetic source which brings into being all our thinking and feeling, our speech and our actions. And all our thinking and feeling, speech and actions, which are the outward expression, the outward garb, indicating the activity of consciousness, have their effect upon this innermost consciousness too. Either it makes the consciousness capable of insight and therefore become enlightened, or it makes that consciousness dull. It covers it up with such a layer of hard mud that one never is capable of seeing the truth of things. And then one is really done for, so to say. Now this consciousness is the thing that undergoes transmutation. And as and when consciousness undergoes transmutation, the very cells of the brain undergo change, undergo mutation. This is something that Krishnamurti has spoken about, but he's never given any sort of further explanation about it. You see, this part of our brain, which is the reptilian and mammalian brain, is a constricting factor as far as the enlightened state is concerned. It is the instrument, the reptilian brain particularly, is the instrument for all our unhappy drives and instincts and all the rest of it. All our aggressiveness, our cruelty, our stupidity and so forth. Look at a crocodile. Charming fellow. But my goodness, damn stupid. The egg-laying group of animals. You see, our brains have taken 400 to 500 million years evolving. We inherit it all. We humans inherit it all. And then came the mammalian, the development of the mammals. And they were a little bit in advance. They gave birth to live young. And their brains have that in them which is the instrument for care and love and protectiveness for the young. It starts with just the young. And then it gradually grows and grows and grows till that fourth branch of the mammalians, who were the primates to start with. And the primates were in four different groups: the prosimians, the monkeys, the apes, and man, the original man. So this brain has evolved that way, and they evolved tens of millions of years ago. So the mammalian part of the brain is much younger than the reptilian part. And then on top of that, as man developed, the cortex grew. And the cortex is the instrument for all that represents the human, the undeveloped human, insofar as he is not very capable and intelligent, but has all the possibilities of a real fulfillment. And particularly the right side of the brain, which is the instrument for the deepest spiritual and intelligent insight into things. So this is how the thing has developed. Now, what part of the brain then will undergo transformation? It is the reptilian mammalian part which is the only thing that can change. The cortex will remain the cortex as such. But if the reptilian mammalian part undergoes change and can get into some sort of harmony, real harmony, with the cortex as such, then the whole of the brain will be the right sort of instrument for the enlightened state. And I think that it is quite probable that in the perfected holy ones, that the brain cells have undergone that change. The reptilian mammalian part has undergone that change and is in harmony. That is why they are utterly harmless. You read the life of the Buddha, one of the most and of Jesus Christ, one of the most outstanding things about their lives is their utter harmlessness. Now, how does this harmlessness come into being? Only by the life of Asha, of Ritta, of Sila, of Yama and Niyama. I'm using the terms of all the different religions. Only by understanding that and living up to that as best as we can. There is no escape from that. If we live that way, we will be able to bring about the necessary renovation of religion that the world desperately needs. You see, this clinging to all the old beliefs and teachings of all the founders of the religions, including the Upanishadic teachers and the Buddha and so forth, several of the things they said must be discarded now, completely discarded. The change which has taken place in the world is such that it needs a complementary development in the spiritual sphere. And who can bring it about but people like yourselves? The theologians, the professional theologians, and all the clever people who spill gallons of ink, I was nearly going to say milk, who spill gallons of ink over acres of paper, they are not going to do anything of the sort. It's you and I who can do it. And you and I can do it not just by talking or discussing or anything, but by actually living the virtuous life. There is no escape from that. It's not difficult, you know, to live the virtuous life. I think I've told some of you a little story about one of Sylvia's ancestors who suffered from a little rheumatic condition in his shoulder and so forth. And one day he went to his doctor and said, you know, doctor, when I... Don't do it, you damn fool, said the doctor. It's as easy as that, don't do it. And it is as difficult as that. abstention from action is very often far more difficult than performing the action, letting go. So we have to understand that that is the sort of thing that lies before us. Your influence through the development in your consciousness will affect your environment, will affect all other people. Why has the teachings of the perfected Holy One not only survived through millennia, but has overflowed the boundaries of the lands in which they taught? Because their consciousness, having reached this holistic state of unitary wholeness, has released such a tremendous energy, a spiritual energy, that the religions have survived. Otherwise, they wouldn't have. That is what you and I can do, if we will.